or a prescriptive theory on the assumption that there are certain intellectual processes that rational players are not capable of the kind involved in taking a hint. It is an empirical question whether rational players, either jointly or individually, can actually do better than a purely formal game theory predicts, and should consequently ignore the strategic principles produced by such a theory. Again, it should be emphasized that the reason why this kind of consideration does not arise in the zero-sum game is that any such social interaction could not be to the advantage of both players simultaneously, and that at least one of the rational players would have both motive and ability to destroy all social communication. But in a non-zero-sum game that involves any initial uncertainty over which among the possible outcomes are in fact efficient and any need for coordinated mutual accommodation to get to an efficient outcome, a rational player cannot absent himself in self-defense from the social process. He cannot turn off his hearing aid to avoid being constrained by what he hears, if complete radio silence makes efficient collaboration impossible. Nor can he rationally fail to open a letter once it is delivered, since the other party will have assumed that he will open it and have acted accordingly. At this point, a question arises whether the game theory trail ramifies indefinitely over the whole domain of social psychology, or leads into a more limited area particularly congenial to game theory. Are there some general propositions about cooperative behavior in mixed motive games that can be discovered by experiment or observation, and that yield a widely applicable insight into the universe of bargaining situations? Although success is not assured, there are certainly some promising areas for research. And even if we cannot discover general propositions, we may at least disprove empirically some that are widely held. It does appear that game theory is badly underdeveloped from the experimental side. Consider a game like the one described earlier involving the movement of counters over a map, or the modified chess game that was made non-zero sum. These can be taken to represent games in limited war. Both players can gain by successfully avoiding mutually destructive strategies. Here is a game in which the ability of the two players to avoid mutual destruction may well depend on what means for successful coordination of intentions are provided by the incidental details of the game, by such things as a configuration of the map or board, the suggested names of the pieces, the tradition or precedent that goes with the game, and the scenario or connotative background that is instilled into the players before the game begins. It is a sufficiently complicated game to require perceptive play by both sides and the successful conveyance of intentions. If we suppose for a moment that the technical problem of constructing a playable game of that type has been mastered, it is worthwhile to consider what line of questions we might try to investigate, or what hypotheses we might test. One such question would be this. By and large, does it appear that the players are any more successful in reaching an efficient solution, that is, a mutually non-destructive solution, when A, full or nearly full communication is allowed, B, no communication or virtually none is allowed other than what can be conveyed by the moves themselves, or C, communication is asymmetrical, with one party more able to send messages than he is to receive them? There is no guarantee that a single universally applicable answer would emerge. Nevertheless, some quite general valid propositions about the role of communication might well be discovered. The enormous significance of this question is attested by some of the current controversies about whether the possibility of keeping war limited is greater if there is good communication between both sides, or if there are unilateral declarations ahead of time by one side or the other, or if there is virtually no overt communication between the belligerents. Another set of questions, also pertinent to problems of limited war, international or other, would be whether a stable, efficient outcome is more likely when the connotations of the game, The names and interpretations that are overtly attached to the moves and pieces and objects on the board are familiar and recognizable, or, when they are quite novel, unfamiliar and unlikely to inspire similar notions in the two players. Is it, to speak of the game in a particular extensive form, more likely that rational players can keep a war limited in Southeast Asia using conventional and atomic weapons, or in a battle against an unknown adversary on the surface of the moon using strange bacterial weapons? These are important questions. They are at the very center of game theory. And they are questions that cannot possibly be given a confident answer without empirical evidence. And there is no arguing that rational players have the intellectual capacity to rise above these details of the game and ignore them. The importance of the details is that they can be supremely helpful to both players, and that rational players know that they may be dependent on using these details as props in the course of their mutual accommodation. Is a stable, efficient outcome more likely between two players of similar temperament and cultural background, or between two quite different players? Is a stable, efficient solution more likely with two practiced players, two novices, or one novice and a practiced player? And in the latter pair, who has the advantage? In a game of this sort, how crucial are the opening moves? If stable patterns of behavior, that is, rules of the game, are not discovered early, will they be discovered at all? Is mutually successful play more likely if the general philosophy of each player is to begin with tight rules or highly limited weapons and resources, loosening them a little only as the occasion demands it? Or if each player sets himself wider limits at the outset in order to avoid having to establish a practice of loosening rules as he goes? How much influence on a game of this sort can a mediator have, and what kinds of mediating roles are most effective? Does it help or hinder the other two players if the mediator has a stake of his own in the outcome? To what extent can a mediator discriminate in favor of one of the two players and still increase the likelihood of a stable, efficient outcome? It would be interesting in a game of this sort to have the players score both themselves and their partners from time to time, on such matters as who is playing the more aggressively or the more cooperatively, and what rules each thinks are in force and thinks the other thinks are in force. Of who is winning in a bilateral sense, it being recalled that the substantial ignorance of each other's value system makes this always a matter of interpretation. Of when the game has reached a critical turning point, or when an innovation in tactics has been introduced, or when a particular move by the other side is to be interpreted as retaliation or a new initiative. Because a law of reprisal is essentially casuistic in nature, because the mutually recognized restraints in any form of limited war are essentially based on something psychologically and sociologically akin to tradition, and because the received body of casuistry and tradition is often wholly inadequate to the game at hand, say, graduated atomic reprisal on the USSR and America while limited atomic war obtains in Europe, or the bombing of grammar schools in an area without recent experience in racial violence, or the introduction of new forms of non-price competition in a particular industry. It seems likely that the empirical part of game theory will include experimental work like that of Muzaffer Sharif. He finds that when no norms exist for a laboratory judgment, they are created by the subjects. And when norms are created for two parties in the same process, each player's developing norm influences the others. There is a process of genuine learning with respect to values. Each side adapts its own system of values to the others, informing its own. When the supply of available objective criteria is incapable of yielding a complete set of rules, that is, when the game is indeterminate, norms of some sort must be developed, mutually perceived, and accepted. Patterns of action and response have to be legitimized. In an almost unconsciously cooperative way, adversaries must reach a mutually recognized definition of what constitutes an innovation, a challenging or assertive move, or a cooperative gesture. And they must develop some common norm regarding the kind of retaliation that fits the crime when a breach of the rules occurs. A scenario might, for example, identify one of the players as aggressor. It might give the outcomes of previous plays of the same game by other players. It might give a background story that would tend to identify some particular division of the terrain as corresponding to an original status quo. Or it might seem to attach a kind of moral claim of one of the players to particular parts of the board. These background data would have no influence on the logical or mathematical structure of the game. They would be intended to have no force except power of suggestion. Again, one might set up the board so that on the first play it corresponds to the way it stood in the middle of the same game as played earlier by two other players, and see whether the outcome can be affected by informing the players of what the starting lineup was in that earlier game. If players tend to develop norms based on the static configuration of the game as they appreciate it at the outset, it may be possible to distort those norms by providing, in a completely non-authoritative way, a background story that suggestively indicates some other hypothetical starting point. It should also be interesting to see whether each player can really discern when the other is testing his determination, daring him, and so forth. And it might be possible to study the process by which particular encounters become invested with symbolic importance, such that each player recognizes that he is establishing a role and reputation in the way he conducts himself at a particular point in the game. Another dimension of the game that seems susceptible of analysis is the significance of the incrementalism that is involved in the moves and value systems. Take, for example, a game that involves moving pieces over a board or troops over some terrain. If players move in turn, each moving one piece, one square at a time, the game proceeds at a slow tempo by small increments. The situation on the board may change character in the course of play, but it does so by a succession of small changes that can be observed, appreciated, and adapted to, with plenty of time for the mistakes of individual players or mutual mistakes that destroy value for both of them to be observed, adapted to, and avoided in subsequent play. If there is communication, there is time for the players to bargain verbally and to avoid moves that involve mutual destruction. But suppose that, instead, the pieces can be moved several at a time in any direction and any distance, and that the rules make the outcome of any hostile clash enormously destructive for one or both sides. Now the game is not so incremental. Things can happen abruptly. There may be a temptation toward surprise attack. While one can see what the situation is at a particular moment, he cannot project it more than a move or two ahead. There seems to be less chance to develop a modus vivendi, or tradition of trust, or dominant and submissive roles for the two players, because the pace of the game brings things to a head before much experience has been gained or much of an understanding reached. But does a more incremental game make successful collaboration easier, or does it just invite a riskier mode of play? Or does this depend on what kinds of people the players are and on what suggestions we plant in the game itself? Is the critical factor the incrementalism of the moves in the game or incrementalism in the value systems of the players, that is, of the scoring system? Or can these be made commensurate with each other, so that incrementalism can be introduced into a game in one dimension to offset the lack of it in another? The relevance of these questions is attested by the controversy over the role of nuclear weapons in limited war, the significance of the temptation to surprise attack in a situation that depends on mutual deterrence, and various proposals to reduce the tempo of modern war and to isolate it geographically, together with disagreement over whether there can be such a thing as limited war on the continent of Western Europe. Incrementalism may be comparatively amenable to formal analysis once the necessary empirical benchmarks have been identified by experiment or observation. These questions have concerned two-person games except for the possible role of the mediator. Similar games could be played by three or more participants, each on his own account. And the author conjectures that, at least among successful players, many of the empirical results would appear in sharper relief with the larger number of players. More generally, the kind of coordination involved in the formation of mobs and coalitions may lend itself to experimental study, in contrast to the more sanitary, symmetrical schemes that have sometimes been used to study the formation of coalitions in game theory. It might prove more interesting to introduce deliberately certain asymmetries, precedents, orders of moves, imperfect communication structures, and various connotative details, in order to study the crystallization of groups. Certainly, the influence exerted on the formation of coalitions by various kinds of asymmetrical and otherwise imperfect communication systems often lends itself to systematic experimental study. Part 3. Strategy with a Random Ingredient. Chapter 7. Randomization of Promises and Threats. In the theory of games of pure conflict, zero-sum games, randomized strategies play a central role. It may be no exaggeration to say that the potentialities of randomized behavior account for most of the interest in game theory during the past 1.5 decades. The essence of randomization in a two-person zero-sum game is to preclude the adversary's gaining intelligence about one's own mode of play, to prevent his deductive anticipation of how one may make up one's own mind, and to protect oneself from telltale regularities of behavior that an adversary might discern or from inadvertent bias in one's choice that an adversary might anticipate. In the games that mix conflict with common interest, however, randomization plays no such central role, and the role it does play is rather different. Randomization in the theory of these non-zero-sum games is not mainly concerned with preventing one's strategy from being anticipated. In these games, as noted earlier, one is often more concerned with making the other player anticipate one's mode of play, and anticipate it correctly, than with disguising one's strategy. There may, of course, be zero-sum components embedded in a larger game. In limited war, one may be concerned to communicate rather than to disguise the limits that one proposes to observe, but within those limits may sortie his aircraft in a randomized way to minimize the enemy's tactical intelligence. Again, information samples may be exchanged or agreements enforced on a sample basis, where neither party can afford to yield the other full knowledge. Arms control agreements, for example, might have to be monitored by a sampling technique that yielded each side enough knowledge about the enemy's forces to reveal compliance or non-compliance, without yielding so much that the possibility of successful surprise attack on those forces were greatly enhanced. But the main role of randomization in the traditional literature on non-zero-sum games is a different one. It has been a device to make indivisible objects divisible or incommensurate objects homogeneous. Their expected values are divisible by lottery when the objects themselves are not. We flip coins to see who gets the object and play double or nothing when we cannot make change. We can divide the obligation of citizenship equally by selecting draftees through a lottery, when we want a fraction of the eligibles for a long period of service rather than all of them for a short one. In this role, randomization is evidently relevant to promises. If the only favors available to be promised are larger than necessary and not divisible, a lottery that offers a specified probability of the favors being granted can scale down the expected value of the promise and reduce the cost to the person making it. An offer to help a person on a large scale in a contingency is somewhat equivalent to offering the certainty of smaller help. There may be the additional advantage that the contingency is correlated with his need. But in this respect, a promise is different from a threat. The difference is that a promise is costly when it succeeds, and a threat is costly when it fails. A successful threat is one that is not carried out. If I promise more than I need to as an inducement, and the promise succeeds, I pay more than I needed to. But a threat that is too big is likely to be superfluous rather than costly. If I threaten to blow us both to bits when it would have been sufficient to threaten our discomfort, you'll likely still comply. Since I have neither to discomfort us nor to kill us, the error costs nothing. If all I had was a grenade to explode in our midst and wished for tear gas instead, I might scale down the grenade to the size of a tear gas bomb by threatening an appropriate percentage chance that the bomb would go off, killing us both, if you failed to comply. But the need to do this is not as clear as in the case of a promise, where any excess in the value promised is so much loss. The size of the threat can be a problem if it costs something to be equipped to make a threat, and if bigger threats cost more to make than small ones. If a threat of tear gas is enough, so that I do not need to threaten explosion, and if tear gas bombs are cheaper than explosive ones, and if I have to display the bomb to make the threat persuasive, it is better to threaten with the cheaper tear gas. But grenades may be cheaper, and then the incentive goes the other way. For many interesting threats, the greatest cost is the risk of having to carry it out, and the more ordinary cost is not a controlling factor. The risk of failure. The risk of failure, however, does give an incentive to choose moderate rather than excessive threats. If the only threat that can be made is some horrendous act, one may be tempted to scale it down by attaching it to a lottery device, by threatening some specified probability that it will be carried out unless compliance is forthcoming, not by committing oneself to the certainty that the jointly painful punishment would be administered. To illustrate, consider the matrix in Figure 17 in the supplement, in which column has first choice, followed by row, but in which row has the option of making a prior threat to constrain column's choice. Interpret X and Y as positive numbers. On one condition, row's strategy is clearly to threaten row lowercase Roman numeral 2 if column chooses column uppercase Roman numeral 2. If he makes no threat, column chooses uppercase Roman numeral 2, knowing that row will then choose lowercase Roman numeral 1. Given the threat, and assuming that row is committed to it and that column knows it, the choice of uppercase Roman numeral 2 yields unattractive outcomes for both of them, and column can be expected to choose uppercase Roman numeral 1. The condition is that row be quite sure that nothing will go wrong. Maybe he completely misjudges column's payoffs. Maybe this particular adversary is drawn from a universe in which nearly everyone, but not quite everyone, has preferences as indicated in the matrix, and a few deviants have a radically different preference system and prefer the lower right cell to the upper left one. Alternatively, Roe may get himself committed to his threat, but fail to communicate it convincingly to Column, so that Column mistakenly ignores the threat, condemning them both to the lower right-hand cell. Again, Column himself may have arranged a prior commitment through his own choice of uppercase Roman numeral 2, and failed to communicate it accurately to Roe in time for Roe to take this into account. Or Column may have suffered a disability unknown to Roe that eliminates the possibility of uppercase Roman numeral 1. In that case, Roe's own commitment will only guarantee the worst outcome for both players. Whatever the reasons for failure, there is perhaps some probability that the threat will fail. If we take it into account, we may have a reason for Rowe to wish that the punitive payoffs in the lower right-hand cell were not quite as unattractive as they are. If Rowe is confined to pure strategies, if he must specify his threat or commitment without reference to error or chance, he can do nothing but wish that the numbers in the lower right-hand cell were not so unattractive. But if he can randomize his threat, he can in fact scale it down to reduce somewhat the high cost of failure. If, for example, he can commit himself not to a choice of row lowercase Roman numeral 2 in the event that column uppercase Roman numeral 2 is chosen, but to a 50-50 chance between lowercase Roman numeral 1 and lowercase Roman numeral 2 in that event, he may still hope to frighten column into a choice of uppercase Roman numeral 1, while reducing the seriousness of the risk of failure. We can be more specific. Let P stand for the probability that the threat will fail for any reason whatsoever. For our present purpose, this is an autonomous probability, independent of Rowe's strategy. Let Rowe now threaten to choose lowercase Roman numeral 2 with probability equal to pi, in the event column chooses uppercase Roman numeral 2. In other words, if column fails to comply, there is a probability of pi that Rowe will choose lowercase Roman numeral 2 to their mutual discomfort, and of the quantity 1 minus pi, that he will choose lowercase Roman numeral 1 to their mutual relief. What value of pi should Rowe choose? First, how large does pi have to be to make the threat effective at all? That is, to make it effective, assuming it does not fail for any of the autonomous reasons involved in P. This is a question of column's choice when he is confronted with the risk pi. If column chooses uppercase Roman numeral 1, he gets 0. If he chooses uppercase Roman numeral 2, his expectation is a weighted average of 1 and minus x, with weights of the quantity 1 minus pi and pi, respectively. If this average is less than 0, he is motivated to choose uppercase Roman numeral 1, subject to the autonomous probability P, that for one reason or another, he will choose uppercase Roman numeral 2 in spite of his apparent motivation toward uppercase Roman numeral 1. The condition for an effective threat is thus 0 is greater than the quantity 1 minus pi minus pi times x. Pi is greater than 1 divided by 1 plus x. Second, assume that any threat with pi above the floor established by the preceding formula will succeed or fail with probabilities the quantity 1 minus p and p respectively. If the threat succeeds, Rowe's payoff is plus 1. If it fails, his expectation is a weighted average of 0 and minus y, the weights being the quantity 1 minus pi and pi respectively. The expected value of the outcome, then, when the threat is large enough to be effective at all, is given by the quantity 1 minus p plus the quantity p times the quantity 0 minus pi times y equals 1 minus p times pi times y. This value is evidently higher the lower is the value of pi. Rowe should therefore arrange the lowest value of pi that he can that meets the first condition. For a threat to be worthwhile at all, to have an expected value greater than 0, which is what Rowe can expect from this particular matrix if he makes no threat, a value of pi must be arranged that meets the condition 1 minus p times pi times y is greater than 0, or 1 minus p divided by p times 1 divided by y is greater than pi. Thus, the effective range for pi in this example is given by 1 minus p divided by p times 1 divided by y is greater than pi is greater than 1 divided by 1 plus x. And there is no threat at all worth making if there is no room between these two limits. If 1 minus p divided by p times y is less than 1 divided by 1 plus x, or p divided by 1 minus p is greater than x plus 1 divided by y. Only a fractional threat, a threat with pi less than 1, is worth making if 1 minus p divided by p times y is less than 1, or p divided by 1 minus p is greater than 1 divided by y. Here is a case, then, in which the fractional threat is superior to the certainty threat, and in which the latter could not be worth making at all while the former were. The argument hinges on the risk of failure, a risk that has been assumed independent of the size of pi itself. This is a somewhat special assumption. If we interpret p as the probability that we have misjudged our adversary and exaggerate his preference for avoiding the lower right cell, our assumption implies a bimodal distribution of payoffs in the population. It implies that we have either a man whose payoffs are adequately represented by the numbers in our matrix, or a man whose payoffs are so different that no relevant threat within the range of values up to pi equals 1 will dissuade him. If instead we supposed that the ratio of column payoffs in the upper and lower right-hand cells showed a bell-shaped frequency distribution within the population, and that our particular adversary had been drawn at random, the probability that our threat would succeed would vary directly with the value of pi itself. The probability that a burglar drawn at random from the universe of burglars will be deterred by some specified probability of apprehension and conviction presumably varies directly with the latter probability. The simple model analyzed here treats burglars as divisible into two classes, those, let us say, who steal for money and are certainly deterred in accordance with the numbers of the matrix, and those who steal for fun and are beyond reach of any threat of the magnitude entered in the lower right-hand cell. On the other hand, if our probability of failure reflected, say, a breakdown of communication with the adversary, there might be better reason for supposing the probability of failure to be independent of the particular threat being communicated. It is interesting to notice that attaching a probability of fulfillment to our threat is, in the previous model, substantially equivalent to scaling down the size of the threat more directly. To see this, interpret X in the lower right-hand cell as a fine that will be levied on both row and column, or a number of lashes with the whip or days of imprisonment that both will suffer if the threat is fulfilled. If X is the maximum number of dollars, lashes, or days that Rho can threaten, let pi be interpreted as Rho's specification of what fraction of the maximum permissible penalty is to be exacted. If pi is set at 0.5, for example, both Rho and column receive exactly half their maximum punishments. If we interpret the matrix in this way and ask what value of pi provides the optimum threat from Rho's point of view, we go through the same analysis and we reach the same conclusion as before. Namely, pi is to be as small as possible, subject to a minimum value equal to 1 divided by the quantity 1 plus x. Thus, we can interpret pi either as a probability of threat fulfillment, or as the scale on which the threat is to be certainly carried out. Since the two formulations come to the same thing, and we can interpret pi either way, it seems fair to say that in this case the role of randomization is that of making divisible an otherwise too large and indivisible threat, of making possible a smaller threat than was otherwise available. It should be noted, though, that to reduce a threat by reducing the probability of its fulfillment reduces the expected value of the outcome proportionately for both players. While a direct reduction in size might not be restricted to proportionate changes in value or utility for the two parties. The risk of inadvertent fulfillment. There is another cost element that can motivate a reduced threat. This is the risk that one will fulfill the threat inadvertently, even if the adversary does comply with it, or would have complied if the threat hadn't gone off accidentally before he had a chance. The gun that threatens a burglar or hold-up victim may go off accidentally before he has a chance to comply. The dog that threatens to bite trespassers may bite some who do not trespass. If a hitchhiker pulls a gun on the driver of a car and the driver threatens to kill them both unless the hitchhiker throws his gun out the window, making his threat by pressing the accelerator to the floor and creating a manifest risk of fatal accident, there is some chance that the accident will occur before the hitchhiker has a chance to comprehend the threat and comply. In this case, the risk of accidental fulfillment is an integral part of the threat. The only way one can make the threat is to start fulfilling it. Until the driver speeds up, the hitchhiker has no reason to believe him. Once he does speed up, there is some minimum length of time it takes the hitchhiker to comply and the driver to relax his speed. There is therefore an interval, however short it may be, that the risk is present. The risk entailed by the high speed must therefore be one that is small enough to be tolerable to the driver during this initial interval. If instead the car were definitely safe at all speeds under 60, but would certainly skid off the road at exactly 60, and there were no gradations between that carried a moderate risk of accident, the driver could have no incentive to incur a dangerous speed, and the hitchhiker would know it and not respond to a verbal threat of high speed. It is the possibility of a fractional threat, a threat that carries the risk but not the certainty of death, that gives the driver anything to work with. But to put it into effect, he has to suffer it for some finite period. If in situations of this kind we suppose, as is roughly true in the hitchhiker case, that the risk of inadvertent fulfillment is proportionate to the probability, pi, that one will fulfill the threat if the adversary does not comply, if the watchdog's propensity to bite innocent passers-by is proportionate to his proclivity to bite those who enter the premises, a formula is obtained that is not very dissimilar to the one already arrived at. Using the same matrix as before, ignoring this time the probability that a potentially effective threat may fail, and letting A times pi represent the probability of inadvertent fulfillment, the minimum value of pi is the same as before. The expected value of the outcome to rho, which must exceed zero if he is to make the threat, is given by the left-hand side of the formula. The quantity 1 minus a times pi minus a times pi times y is greater than 0, or 1 divided by a times the quantity 1 plus y is greater than pi is greater than 1 divided by 1 plus x. The optimal threat is again one that barely exceeds the lower limit. There is an upper limit to pi that may be less than 1. And depending on the relative values of x and y and the cost parameter a, it may or may not be possible to find a profitable value for pi at all. Randomized commitments. Having found a rationale for a fractional threat, we can inquire whether the tactic of unconditional commitment, too, is one that in certain cases can advantageously be made less than certain. As indicated in chapters 3 and 5, a pure commitment, that is, a definite commitment to a pure strategy, is equivalent to first move in a two-person, two-move game in which one would otherwise have to move second. It is a means of obtaining the equivalent of first move. We have to relax that interpretation if we suppose that Rho, who has second move in the game but who has the option to commit himself ahead of time, commits himself to a 50-50 chance of choosing Rho lowercase Roman numeral 1 or lowercase Roman numeral 2. To do this, one must retain the right to move second, exploiting only the right to commit oneself ahead of time. If one had actually to move first, by a definite choice, the possibility of a randomized commitment would be lost. The randomized commitment is equivalent to a first move determined by a random device with odds set by the player, with the odds but not the actual move known to the other player before his own move. The same payoff matrix, figure 1 in the supplement, can be used to illustrate this situation if we change the rules of the game to permit row an unconditional commitment prior to column's choice, but not permitting him to make his choice depend on columns. A firm commitment to lowercase Roman numeral 2 induces a choice of column uppercase Roman numeral 1, but is wasted because the lower left cell, to which Row is now committed, contains no reward. Row's problem is that he needs Row lowercase Roman numeral 2 to induce column into uppercase Roman numeral 1, but he needs Row lowercase Roman numeral 1 to profit from uppercase Roman numeral 1. A compromise can be achieved by a randomized commitment, a commitment to a randomized choice. If Row is committed to flip a coin, 50-50 chance, to select lowercase Roman numeral 1 or lowercase Roman numeral 2 after column has chosen, column will choose uppercase Roman numeral 1 as long as X is greater than 1. In that case, Row gets an expected value of 0.5. If Row sets pi, the probability of his choosing lowercase Roman numeral 2, at just above 1 divided by the quantity 1 plus x, he gets the largest expected value consistent with column's choice of uppercase Roman numeral 1. If column's payoff in the lower left cell differs from 0, say 0.5 or minus 0.5, the formula for optimum value of pi differs somewhat. If Row's payoff in the lower left cell were minus 1, no commitment with a greater than 50% chance of lowercase Roman numeral 2 would serve. And if that payoff were minus x or worse, no probability mixture of lowercase Roman numeral 1 and lowercase Roman numeral 2 would work. Any mixture with pi large enough to induce column uppercase Roman numeral 1 would be too large to yield Row a positive expected value. There is another rationale for a fractional commitment. In the case just discussed, it was Row's own preference for the upper cell in uppercase Roman numeral 1 that led him to minimize the value of pi. In Figure 18 in the supplement, it is column's motivation that demands some chance of Row lowercase Roman numeral 1, that is, a fractional value of pi. In this case, a firm commitment to Row lowercase Roman numeral 2 induces column to choose uppercase Roman numeral 2. A firm commitment to lowercase Roman numeral 1 induces column to choose uppercase Roman numeral 1. No commitment at all leaves column preferring uppercase Roman numeral 2. A threat to choose lowercase Roman numeral 1 unless column chooses uppercase Roman numeral 1 will be ineffective unless Row promises to abstain from choosing lowercase Roman numeral 2. In all of these pure strategy cases, Row ends up with a score of 2. He can, however, do slightly better with a mixed commitment. He can because he and column are both attracted to column uppercase Roman numeral 1, disagreeing only over the choice of Row in that column. If he offers column a 50-50 chance between Row's lowercase Roman numeral 1 and lowercase Roman numeral 2, column gets an expected value of 2 in the first column, of 1.5 in the second, and chooses the first. This leaves Row an expected value of 2.5. Since Row has a preference for lowercase Roman numeral 2, he wants the highest probability of that row consistent with the need to provide column with a preference for column uppercase Roman numeral 1. That is, he wants the largest value of pi for which, in the matrix shown, 4 times the quantity 1 minus pi is greater than the quantity 1 minus pi plus 2 times pi, or 3 divided by 5 is greater than pi. This particular mixed commitment can be called a combination of a fractional threat with a fractional promise, Rho, in effect, threatens a relatively high probability of lowercase Roman numeral 1 in the event that uppercase Roman numeral 2 is chosen, and promises it if uppercase Roman numeral 1 is chosen. He could do even better if he could make pi conditional on column's choice. Any probability up to 0.75 for rho lowercase Roman numeral 2, conditional on a choice of column uppercase Roman numeral 1, is a sufficient inducement if it is certain that rho will retaliate for column uppercase Roman numeral 2 with rho lowercase Roman numeral 1. But if he is limited to making his threat no worse than his promise is good, if he has to attach the same probability to both of them, the upper limit to an effective value of pi is 0.6, with an expected value to rho of 2.6 and of 1.6 for column. With a separate pi for the promise, the upper limit is 0.75 for an expected payoff of 2.75 and only 1.0 for column. Chapter 8. The Threat That Leaves Something to Chance. It is typical of strategic threats that the punitive action, if the threat fails and has to be carried out, is painful or costly to both sides. The purpose is deterrence ex ante, not revenge ex post. Making a credible threat involves proving that one would have to carry out the threat, or creating incentives for oneself or incurring penalties that would make one evidently want to. The acknowledged purpose of stationing American troops in Europe as a tripwire was to convince the Russians that war in Europe would involve the United States, whether the Russians thought the United States wanted to be involved or not, that escape from the commitment was physically impossible. As a rule, one must threaten that he will act, not that he may act, if the threat fails. To say that one may act is to say that one may not, and to say this is to confess that one has kept the power of decision, that one is not committed. To say that only one may carry out the threat, not that one certainly will, is to invite the opponent to guess whether one will prefer to punish himself and his opponent, or to pass up the occasion. Furthermore, if one says that he may, not that he will, and the opponent fails to heed the threat, and the threatener chooses not to carry it out, he only confirms his opponent's belief that when he has a clear choice to act or to abstain, he will choose to abstain, consoling himself that he was not caught bluffing because he never said that he would act for sure. There are threats of this kind, nevertheless, that may be effective in spite of this loophole. They can work, however, only through a process that is a degree more complicated than firm commitment to certain fulfillment. Furthermore, they may arise inadvertently and may entail unintended behavior. For this reason, they are less likely to be recognized and understood. The key to these threats is that, though one may or may not carry them out if the threatened party fails to comply, the final decision is not altogether under the threatener's control. The threat is not quite of the form, I may or may not according as I choose, but has an element of, I may or may not, and even I can't be altogether sure. Where does the uncertain element in the decision come from? It must come from somewhere outside of the threatener's control. Whether we call it chance, accident, third-party influence, imperfection in the machinery of decision, or just processes that we do not entirely understand, it is an ingredient in the situation that neither we nor the party we threaten can entirely control. An example is the threat of inadvertent war. The threat of inadvertent war. The thought that general war might be initiated inadvertently, through some kind of accident, false alarm, or mechanical failure, through somebody's panic, madness, or mischief, through a misapprehension of enemy intentions or a correct apprehension of the enemy's misapprehension of ours, is not an attractive one. As a general rule, one wants to keep such a likelihood to a minimum, and on the particular occasions when tension rises and strategic forces are put on extraordinary alert, when the incentive to react quickly is enhanced by the thought that the other side may strike first, it seems particularly important to safeguard against impetuous decision, errors of judgment, and suspicious or ambiguous modes of behavior. It seems likely that, for both human and mechanical reasons, the probability of inadvertent war rises with a crisis. But is not this mechanism itself a kind of deterrent threat? Suppose the Russians observe that whenever they undertake aggressive action, tension rises and this country gets into a sensitive condition of readiness for quick action. Suppose they believe what they have so frequently claimed, that an enhanced status for our retaliatory forces and for theirs may increase the danger of an accident or a false alarm, theirs or ours, or of some triggering incident resulting in war. May they not perceive that the risk of all-out war then depends on their own behavior, rising when they aggress and intimidate, falling when they relax their pressure against other countries? Notice that what rises, as far as this particular mechanism is concerned, is not the risk that the United States will decide on all-out war, but the risk that war will occur whether intended or not. Even if the Russians did not expect deliberate retaliation for the particular misbehavior they had in mind, they could still be uneasy about the possibility that their action might precipitate general war or initiate some dynamic process that could end only in massive war or massive Soviet withdrawal. They might not be confident that we and they could altogether foretell the consequences of our actions in an emergency and keep the situation altogether under control. Here is a threat, if a mechanism like this exists, that we may act massively, not that we certainly will. It could be most credible. Its credibility stems from the fact that the possibility of precipitating major war in response to Soviet aggression is not limited to the possibility of our coolly deciding to attack. It therefore extends beyond the areas and the events for which a more deliberate threat is in force. It does not depend on our preferring to launch all-out war, or on our being committed to in the event the Russians confront us with the fait accompli of a moderately aggressive move. The final decision is left to chance. It is up to the Russians to estimate how successfully they and we can avoid precipitating war under the circumstances. The threat, if we call this contingent behavior mechanism a threat, has some interesting features. It may exist whether we realize it or not. Even those who have doubted whether our massive retaliation threat was a potent deterrent to minor aggression during the last several years, but are perplexed that the Russians have not engaged in more mischief than they have, can note that the threat we voiced was backed by an additional implicit threat that we might be triggered by Soviet actions in spite of ourselves. Furthermore, even if we prefer not to incur even a small probability of inadvertent war and would not use this mechanism deliberately, the threat in question may be a byproduct of other actions that we have a powerful incentive to take. We may get this threat whether we like it or not when we and the Russians take precautions commensurate with a crisis. Knowing this, the Russians may have to take the risk into account. Finally, the threat is not discredited even if the Russians accomplish their purpose without triggering war. If the Russians estimate that the chance of inadvertent war during a particular month rises from very small to not so small if they create a crisis, and they go ahead anyway, and no major war occurs, they still have little reason to suppose that their original estimate was wrong, and little reason to suppose that repetition would be less risky, any more than a person who survives a single play of Russian roulette should decide it isn't dangerous after all. Limited war as a generator of risk. Limited war as a deterrent to aggression also requires interpretation as an action that enhances the probability of a greater war. If we ask how the Western forces in Europe are expected to deter a Russian attack or to resist it if it comes, the answer usually runs in terms of a sequence of decisions. In case of attack on a moderate scale, we could make the decision to fight limited war. It would not be a decision to proceed with mutual annihilation. If we can resist the Russians on a small scale, they must either give up the idea or themselves take a step upward on the scale of violence. At some point, there is a discontinuous jump from limited war to general war, and we hope to confront them with that choice. If this is not the typical sequence of decisions envisaged, it at least seems typical in one respect. It involves deliberate decisions, decisions to take an action or to abstain from it, to initiate a war or not to step up the level of violence or not to respond to a challenge or not to. But another interpretation can be put on limited war. The danger of all-out war is almost certainly increased by the occurrence of a limited war. It is almost certainly increased by an enlargement of limited war. This being so, the threat to engage in limited war has two parts. One is the threat to inflict costs directly on the other side, in casualties, expenditures, loss of territory, loss of face, or anything else. The second is the threat to expose the other party, together with oneself, to a heightened risk of general war. Here again is a threat that all-out war may occur, not that it certainly will occur, if the other party engages in certain actions. Again, whether it does or does not occur is not a matter altogether controlled by the threatener. Just how all-out war would occur, just where the fault, initiative, or misunderstanding may occur, is not sure. Whatever it is that makes limited war between great powers a risky thing, the risk is a genuine one that neither side can altogether dispel if it wants to. The final decision or the critical action that initiates an irreversible process is not something that should necessarily be expected to be taken altogether deliberately. Chance helps to decide whether general war occurs or not, with odds that are a matter of judgment based on the nature of the limited war and the context in which it occurs. Why would one threaten limited war rather than all-out war to deter an attack? First, to threaten limited war, according to this analysis, is to threaten a risk of general war, not the certainty of it. It is consequently a lesser threat than the massively retaliatory threat and more appropriate to certain contingencies. Second, it has the advantage, in case the enemy misjudges our intentions or commitments, of an intermediate stage. We can engage in limited war, creating precisely the risk for both of us that we threatened to create, without thereby making general war the price we both pay for the enemy's mistaken judgment. We pay instead the lesser price of a risk of general war, a risk that the enemy can reduce by withdrawal or settlement. Third, in case the enemy is irrational or impetuous, or we have misjudged his motives or his commitments, or in case his aggressive action has gotten up too much momentum to stop, or his actions are being carried out by puppets or satellites that are beyond his immediate power to control, there is some prudence in threatening risk rather than certainty. If we threaten all-out war, thinking it not too late to stop him, and it is, we must either go ahead with it or have our threat discredited. But if we can threaten him with a 1 in 20 chance of all-out war in the event he proceeds, and he does proceed, we can hold our breath and have 19-to-1 odds of getting off without general war. Of course, if we scale down the risk to us, we scale it down to him, too. It may degrade the threat to put too much safety in it, but in cases where there is danger that we completely misjudge the enemy's commitment to an action, or completely misjudge his ability to control his own agents, allies, or commanders, the more moderate risk may deter anything that is still within his control. If we give this interpretation to limited war, we can give a corresponding interpretation to enlargements, or threats of enlargement, of the war. The threat to introduce new weapons into a limited war is not, according to this argument, to be judged solely according to the immediate military or political advantage, but also according to the deliberate risk of still larger war that it poses. Just as a moderate limited war may increase by a large factor the likelihood of major war within the next 30 days, so a progression from conventional to novel weapons may raise that probability by another factor. We are led in this way to a new interpretation of the tripwire. The analogy for our limited war forces in Europe is not, according to this argument, a tripwire that certainly detonates all-out war if it is in working order, and fails altogether if it is not. What we have is a graduated series of tripwires, each a